Ad she'ava de'emes nidatam. Until they lost truth.
Until they lost truth. Uber Avraham Shana, Hikir Avraham in Zorah.
Now, Avraham was 40 years old when he recognized the Creator. Now, how did he know? How did he know what the cause was? It says that he didn't have any teacher. He didn't have a teacher. So how did he know what the... Then it says that he knew that what had caused this mistake was the fact that they worshipped the stars. And the tzuros, until they had lost the emes midatam. Yeah, good. That, as TV points out, see, there's interesting. The Chazal say that Avram was 3 years old when he recognized
the existence of God.
The Rambam says he was 40 years old. So what's the,
you know, what's the...
Right. So it means that he began when he was 3 years old. That's when he began thinking. But he arrived at the conviction when he was 40 years old. Now, why did it take him so long? Why did it take him that many years?
Was it because intellectually
it was that difficult, it took that many years? Or was it another factor as well? So the Rambam incorporates the idea that while he was thinking about these things, he was also involved in the worship.
So in order for Abraham to
the worship of idols, he says. He says that
his father and mother, the entire nation, were obeyed by the
Zerah, who obeyed him on, and he worshipped with them. So he, while he was thinking,
he was living in two different worlds.
So that answers the question. How did he understand
what brought them to this?
Was that in order for him to discover the truth, he had to extricate himself emotionally. He had to analyze his own emotions.
He was involved in two areas.
He was involved in the study of reality, but that itself was not enough because he still
had within him, he had been raised
with all of these emotions. Remember we said yesterday that once the system is established,
it has a tremendous effect upon people?
Because it affects their emotions, it regiments them from youth.
So it's very difficult to get out of that.
Right, so he had to analyze
his own
emotions. And when he analyzed his emotions, he recognized what the ultimate root of Avodah Zarah was, and he understood the nature of the mistake. Now let's get back at this point and answer a question that we left before. Remember we said that the original, it all began with what seems to be an intellectual mistake. They thought that God wanted them to worship and give honor to the stars, and that would be really a form of giving honor to God. And that is the root of Avodah Zarah. And our question was, but it doesn't seem, it's a mistake, it may be wrong, but why is that the ego of Avodah Zarah? What's the ego? This was in Allah Ha'ala. The Rambam says, who ego of Avodah Zarah? Why is that the ego of Avodah Zarah? Now, says that this is very important because this is the most important concept in the Torah. To know, you see, the Rambam doesn't just go into the halachas of Avodah Chacham, but he gives us a historical background. The whole Torah rests upon the idea of having a true notion of God and ridding ourselves of Avodah Zarah. So what is the Ikar of Avodah Zarah? Let's go back to the cause. What caused them to come up with this idea? See, was this simply an intellectual mistake? Or did it have an emotional basis as well? And what we see from this is that it wasn't purely intellectual. But an intellectual mistake can be based upon a certain emotional predisposition. Now, what C.B. pointed out was that there was a emotional need for what? For security. See, that is the religious instinct in man. Most people turn to God because they feel insecure. And they turn to God for the sense of support of some father figure. You follow? Now, that is okay. That is okay, provided that they have the realization of the true God, and that they cannot relate to any created being as God. They can't perform any act of worship. Once they gratify that emotion, vis-a-vis an act of worship towards a physical object, even if their intention is that it somehow relates to the true God, that's what they want to do. They're satisfying that emotional need. See, that's the whole essence of idolatry. The whole essence of idolatry is to relate to God in a primitive type of a way. In other words, from the standpoint of a person's primitive emotion, his childish emotional need for a father figure. And that's why they construct images. Because an image is always, it's always a representation of some father figure that exists in the mind. So it is taking them away from the God of reality. And that's why the Torah completely forbid us to have any images, to create any images, to have any images, because all of these images are avodah zarah. They are the gratifications of the idolatrous instinct. In other words, the worship of idolatry is an instinctual force within man. Yet it's a very powerful instinctual force. We discussed this, you see, it expressed itself in many ways. Remember when we discussed superstitions? Right? That's, most people have these superstitions and beliefs in magical things and demons. The basic idea, you see, well, that's an instinctual phenomenon. It's a natural emotion within man. And that emotion, if it is allowed to go unchecked, will establish an idolatrous system. So it is really, the whole essence of idolatry is the way in which people relate to God. They relate to God not as the abstract God of heaven and earth, the creator of the universe, who is basically unknowable, but whom we know is the creator. But rather they seek to project certain qualities. See, they said it's like a king, and the king won, and so on and so forth. They're relating to God through the mechanism of projection. And the reason why they're doing it is because of their insecurity. Because they feel they need protection from the forces in the universe. That's what Avram was able to discover because, as C.P. points out, he had all these emotions. He had to remove himself from that framework. Because he was raised to worship idols. So that's why it's been our Avraham Shana. That's why it took 4 years. Because he was working on two fronts. He was working on the objective front, but he was also working on himself. That's the uniqueness. And most people can't do that. And many people that have questions, many people that are involved in false systems, they have questions. But they continue to practice. They don't internalize. He was involved in changing himself over. He had to take this abstract knowledge and internalize it.
That
means he had to confront. Oh, he didn't say when he stopped practicing. The Rambam does not pinpoint when
I'm saying he didn't say when he stops, but he says even while he was involved in the
practice. Yeah, well, I, of course. But at what point did he stop practicing? I don't know.
Okay.
So, this was the essence of his greatness, that he recognized that the reason why a person should worship God is not to achieve any emotional satisfaction, but simply because God is the source of the universe. You understand? There were two things involved over here. There was discovery of the creator, but a person can know the creator and still be an idolater. Because the original of the avodah zarah, they knew the creator, but they were idolaters. So it means the essence of idolatry is the nature in which one relates to the creator. And if a person relates to the creator through the mechanism of certain emotions, and he forms an image, so then he's not really relating to the creator of the universe. He's relating to a certain image. that he has fashioned of the Creator. That is Avodah Zarah, because he's allowing his emotional, religious, instinctual need to be satisfied through through an object. And that's what Avram came to uproot. Two things he did. First of all, the knowledge of the Creator himself, which had been lost, but the way in which a person is to relate to the Creator, that's the essence of Avodah Zarah. Zuiker. That is to say that a person cannot relate to the Creator through the mechanism of those emotions, but he has to relate to the Creator in an entirely different way. And that is that's the greatness of his accomplishment. To review, so we said that the world has become steeped in a primitive kind of Avodah Zarah, which was bowing down to different tzuros, different images, and that Avraham Avinu had rediscovered the true ideas. But we said that he not only recognized the existence of the Creator, but he also understood the psychology of the Avodah Zarah, which was that people had a religious instinct and that they were searching for a certain type of emotional security. So there are two ways that a person could relate to God. A person can relate to God via his natural emotional feeling that there is a being out there that's looking over him. That's a psychological phenomenon. That's one derech. That's one approach. Now that approach, if it's not checked, will lead to Avodah Zarah, because it requires, what he's looking for is a satisfaction of a certain psychological need. And that satisfaction can only come from a being that he can identify with in a emotional way. That's why it requires a form, it requires an image, ultimately. And that went back, that need was to be found in the original mistake, even of those who were on a high intellectual level, who believed in the existence of God, but they said that God, like a king, wants you to give honor to his servants and ministers, so too God wants you to give honor to those whom he has established on high. That already, in that mistake, it wasn't purely an intellectual mistake, but it had that emotional component as well. And Abraham understood this from his own nature, because he studied his own nature, and that's why it says later on that even though he didn't have a teacher, he understood what had brought mankind to this level, had brought them to this level, was the fact that they worshipped, they bowed down to tzuros, to images, which means that they were searching for emotional security, and they didn't relate to God through the mind as the creator of the universe. So Shay is asking, what about an atheist? How is it different? We have to try and understand that phenomenon.
Atheists just have an interest in emotion. It's still there. Like, there are no atheists in a foxhole.
That is true.
By nature, no one is an atheist. It's not by man's nature being an atheist. That's a force upon. That's something that, yeah. Emotion that's forced upon.
What we said was last year, I think the year before, we said was that basically man by nature is not atheistic. Man by nature is religious.
Mm-hmm.
Even atheists have their own type of religion. They usually worship.
So what man?
It's in the nature of a person to worship. The emotion to worship is innate in man. And even the biggest atheists, you'll find that they have substituted. They may deny the existence of God as we know it, but they have replaced God with something else. They have to worship something. So they worship human mind.
They don't do it as a religion.
In other words, it's usually, there are different emotions in a person. There are different emotions. Everybody, even religious people, have rebellious emotions against, there's a certain emotion against authority. Everybody doesn't like the idea of having to be subservient to an authority. Correct? That's why even religious people have problems. They're rebellious. Like, why do I have to do this? And why does God do that? They accept God, but they're rebelling. Then there are people that can't accept the idea of an authority above them. But what they do is, they have to. In other words, they have to believe that there's something more out there than just what they see. The idea to deify, that is to discover the ultimate force, that's a very powerful emotion. So what they do is they project it onto human mind, technology. With the Nazis, it becomes the Aryan race, or the communist, it becomes the state, it becomes... It takes on many, many different forms and shapes, but it's essentially really not that different. To bear with me for a second. It's not that different than Avodah Zarah. Because as I told you, the images that they project are where they derive from. They derive from images within their mind of parental figures. So it's always... The only difference is that it's a more psychological phenomenon. That these parental figures are disguised and are objectified in the forms of images. Whereas the atheist supposedly is more sophisticated than that. He doesn't go by that entire system. But the idea that the ultimate force on earth is man. Man is the highest creature. And human might is what he worships. He worships human might. So he's not truly without the religious instinct. While he may be called an atheist, he's still a very religious kind of an atheist, wouldn't you say? It seems to be that there are two factors over here. There is the religious need, the religious instinct. Because religion is an instinctual phenomenon. It's not something that only comes into being when you have an advanced society. Primitive societies are very religious. So it's a drive. Now, how it expressed itself in the form, if you take a look at the forms that it takes, the religious practices, the ideas that form the basis of the religion, you'll see that it has a lot to do with the childhood psychology. And it makes sense that it should, because the person is basically searching for a state of security. Now, when the mind does that, it shifts back to that stage in life when it, at least emotionally, felt secure. And how do you feel secure? Under the protection of a parent. So all these ideas are basically unconscious. And as the person matures a little bit, so what he's looking for, psychologically speaking, this is something which goes on every day, even if it doesn't take on the form of a religion, but people are searching for it in different forms. You know what I mean? Like as a teenager, you're not that close with your own, and you may break away. A teenager tries to break away from his immediate. It's interesting, like, that's the time when people are going through a stage of rebellion, but it's, how far can man rebel? Well, he breaks away from his immediate family, so he seeks to replace it with something else. So now he goes to, you know, the coach or the team or the group. They become the substitute. You understand? I mean, it's basically, you can't go too far away, psychologically. What a person does is he exchanges one particular for another particular, but the image that this particular is supposed to relate back to is basically a parental image. Even you see that in the story of creation. When Chava was created, so the pasuk says right away, Al ken yasev ish, es aviv v'yasimo. Therefore a man will separate himself, abandon his father and his mother, v'davak v'yishto, and cling to his wife. V'hayu l'basar echad, and they will become as one flesh. So God's objective, God's will is that a person should be able to live independently of his parents, but he does need, even on the psychological level, some type of a substitute. And in that sense, he, the pasuk, is pretty much saying what modern psychology has discovered recently, then the pasuk in the Torah, you know, v'davak v'yishto, that the idea of substitution of one object for another psychologically is something which is found in the Torah, it's not a new discovery. He really could, because the only way to be truly rebellious is by living the life of Chachma. Anyone that tries to act out of rebelliousness in the emotional framework is basically conforming. He's just following the same value system, but taking a different turn. So he's a conformist. The only true rebel is the one who lives according to Chachma. But if a person lives according to Chachma, he realizes that there's no gain in rebelling against something. He'd rather pursue something positive. So he sees that there's no point in being a rebel, per se. It would be foolish to be influenced by today's so-called philosophy professors, because they don't really know philosophy. They're professors. And a professor is one who's studying the history of something. In other words, he doesn't really understand the underlying arguments. He's not a philosopher himself. He just gives you what they need, a course, which is a review. A review is just an abstract of what this one said and he argued against it, but without really getting into the underlying logic and is not capable of really, you know, showing you whether a position makes sense or doesn't make sense. They're not master logicians. They're not master thinkers. Moreover, they're all operating under the basic premise of modern intellectual life on the campuses, which is that we don't know anything. It's all subjectivism. They themselves don't believe that there's any reality that man can know. And isn't that true? That's what they claim. In other words, all systems are basically equal because that's how you, ultimately you can't prove anything. It's just how you feel about reality. They would feel that they would say that we can't say that our way of life is better than anybody else's way of life or vice versa. Yeah, that's the underlying. It's all relative. That's why the only good is to be a liberal and to respect every different position. I mean, that's basically what it comes out to. How can you... That's what the racism or any type of bigotry is regarded as the worst evil. Because then you're saying that you, by virtue of looking down at somebody else, you're saying that you have the truth. So the worst sin, according to their view, is to say that you have the truth. That's basically what it boils down to. It's absurd, then, for them for anybody to be influenced by these people who believe that there is no such thing as knowledge. Unless you want to study that issue itself, whether there is such a thing as knowledge or not. But I don't see why they even are in the business of education or so-called philosophy or whatever it is they claim to be doing. If you hold that there's no such thing as knowledge, so get out of the school and go do something. Think about it. I don't know. No, they hold that there's nothing we can know. Basically, they hold we don't have any knowledge. In other words, they say that you cannot prove that. That anything in the world of ethics or morality, you can't demonstrate that your belief system is any more true objectively than somebody else's belief system. It's, in other words, it's all subjectivist. There's no reality. It's the common sense view. That's what most people today feel. We have to respect all different viewpoints. For example, most people hold that you can't prove that one religion is truer or better than another. It's all relative. It's all relativist. Okay? Now today's philosophy. Now we don't hold that that's not the case. We hold that there are objective criteria by which you can measure one against the other. There is objective reality, and it's knowable to man. So we dispute that, and we hold that there is such a thing. That's what we call knowledge. Knowledge is knowing what exists in reality. So my point is like this. One second. My point is that if you hold that there is no such thing as knowledge, so what are you involved in? What are you studying for? What is the point? It's a waste of time. Just follow your emotions. And certainly, I don't see why a student should be affected by what these people so-called think when they themselves tell you that their own thoughts have no real value. Isn't that their underlying premise? Do they really believe that their thoughts are true? So then they're saying they know the truth. That's it, and they're not the subjectivists. Okay, so fine. So then we'll listen to them. But a person who claims that he doesn't have knowledge, he's saying, basically, I don't have knowledge. So why do I care that he believes that there's a God that doesn't? That's just an emotional whim of his. We don't have any absolute way of knowing objective reality. Our knowledge is limited. That's the factor that these people base their attack on, trying to break down the idea of knowledge. Because the truth of the matter is, well, you see, even in halacha, we hold that there is an objective halakhic system. Not only by any view has validity, it's only the views of those who really study the subject matter and know how to reason it through. But even so, you'll find that the great scholars who all have top methodology will come to disagreements over points. Oh, but if it's an objective system, how can there be different points of view? The answer is the state of our knowledge may be imperfect, but there is such a thing as an objective truth which we're struggling to get closer to. And reason dictates that we should follow that course. So the way to break these people down is to show them the consequences. That if they truly deny that there is an objective reality, then their whole lives would have to. How do they base any decision in their life? On what basis? It's always in terms. They always use the mind in terms of working out the best system for economically, in terms of physically, in terms of health, in terms of traveling. And so on and so forth. Nobody would ever give equal credence to every view. It would be absurd to give equal credence to every view on how to construct an airplane. Nobody would do that. They'd say there's only one method that we use, scientific testing. and which is basically the application of reason and logic to an area. Thus, it washes the view different when it comes to other areas, other issues, which are not based upon a physical phenomenon, but based upon a psychological phenomenon, or the behavioral phenomenon. When it comes to that area, there we say that every view, based on what they're saying, no matter how crazy it is, you have to give equal credence to it.
Okay.
The point. That happens to be true, because the problem that they get in, that's exactly the problem that they face, as Stevie points out. The problem they face is, so what about a person that believes he's doing wrong with stealing, or with killing, or with raping? That's his philosophy. And you can't tap into this movement. Oh, so then they say, well, you have to draw the line, because you'll destroy all of society. In other words, they say there's anything that a person enjoys is basically good as long as it doesn't hurt somebody else. And first of all, you have to prove why that's the case. Suppose I do hurt somebody else. Why is that to make it, if this is the good, why does that make it wrong? So, you see that they're not entirely consistent as far as that's concerned. If they can't, they're not, obviously it couldn't be. If they were to be that way, well, that's first of all, the mission of failure. Well, you said, because then they break down society. But then, so that's a weakness in your system. You're following a philosophy which, if people were willing to carry it out, you couldn't exist. Man couldn't exist. So they just say, they leave that as, well, that's why we have to put a limitation on this. But I say it's not a limitation. It shows the whole thing is wrong. That's a complete weakness to frame a whole philosophy of life, which if people were to act it out, would destroy the universe. I mean, it's like, well, doesn't make sense from a, that should be the ideal way for man to live his life. So, he says like this, that, Kiva Shihike Vyada, as soon as he recognized and he knew, Hischil Lahashiv Chuvos, Abnei Rekastim, he began to formulate answers, chulos, answers or refutations to the people of Rekastim, Barar of Din Imahem, and to have, what do you mean, Lar of Din? To arrange for, not judgment, but a debate. He began to debate his positions with the people of Rekastim. Volomar, and to say, She'enzu Derech Ha'emes, that this is not the Derech Ha'emes, Sha'atem Holchemba, that you are going in. V'shibe Ha'tzmolim, and he broke the Telem, the images, he smashed the idols. V'hishchil Lahodilam, and he began to teach the people, She'en Ro'i Lavod, that it is not fitting to worship Ella, Le'eloka Ha'olam, except to the God of the world. Below, Roy Lishtachavos, and to him it is fitting to bow, Ulahakriv, and to sacrifice, Lanasech, and to pour libations. Kadesh Yafiru Kalabruah Maboyim, in order that all of the future creations should recognize God. Now let's take that apart. First of all, as soon as he discovered, he made a discovery and he knew, it says, what's the first thing that he did? Hischil Lahashiv Chuvos, Abnei Rekastim. He began to form answers, refutations for the people of Rekastim. Now, why do you do that? I mean, here we're talking about an individual who obviously operated in accordance with reason. Everything he did had a reason. So why did he deal with them? What was the purpose? Until that point, he wasn't involved with them. He was completely alone, studied by himself. In the very first instance, what you're saying is true, of course. He wanted to bring them to the true ideas, but there was a benefit in interacting, in testing your theories. He had worked out his ideas. He came to certain conclusions, but the ultimate clarity is only when you're able to present them and to defend them to others. So you see that this was, on the one hand, it was for his own intellectual benefit to be able to refute. He knew the truth, but it becomes much clearer if he was able to refute the false ideas. So the first thing that he did was that he began to have debates with them. He formulated answers. He began to have debates. And in doing so, it became even clearer to him. It became, not to say that without this it wouldn't have been clear, but it attains a greater degree of clarity. At the same time, he's helping them as well. So if a person really, you see that idea in cookery, in the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, that whoever is chayav to learn is chayav to teach others, right?
No, we also did this,
yeah, and in teaching others is benefits the other person, benefits society at the same time, you're benefiting yourself because you raise your own learning to a higher degree. Mm-hmm. Now, then he says like this. It's interesting, the Rambam works out every step precisely. First he began to have reputation. Then he came to the conclusion of Alomar. Then he said, "She'ein zuru derech emes," that this is not the true path. Shatem holkumba. Then he showed them that even further. See, because the first step is just I can take a person from today's society. He gets into a discussion and you show him that a certain idea that he has doesn't make any sense. That's one step. What's the next step? She'ein zuru derech emes. What's he pointing out there? There's more.
The whole foundation.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Like you see a lot of, very often you'll have a friend of yours, he'll show him an idea here or there, it doesn't make sense, he'll listen. But then it's a big jump to show him, it's not just this particular that you're wrong on or that particular, but your whole methodology is wrong. The whole foundation. See? But you can't, see, if you attack a person right away and you say, your whole way of thinking is faulty, he's just going to reject you, he'll just turn you out. He's not listening to you. So first you have to show him some particulars, this idea, that idea. Then the person speaking, how come? Why is it that every time, every idea that I have is incorrect? Then you can point out that the derech, your whole derech is wrong. You don't have a derech. Now, take a look, what's the next thing that he does? The shibur hatzlam. Then he breaks the images. Now why did he do that? I mean, the mother shock. It would seem that what was his methodology for dealing with the people? Bring them back. If it was rationality and not violence, not to go around destroying, so then he should have stuck to rationality. And if his idea was that you have to go around and destroy the idol, so he should have done that. And what is the combination? It seems that first he starts off with rationality, and he doesn't attack the idol. And all of a sudden, boom, he becomes like a violent person and he's attacking the idol. He had to use both. Had he simply gone ahead and destroyed the idols, then it wouldn't have had any effect. Of course, they weren't prepared intellectually. So first he had to prepare them and pave the way intellectually. However, I think Daniel said a good thing. And that is that sometimes a person is at a stage where his intellect and his emotions are not necessarily in line. Very often a person is convinced that something that he's doing is bad. Intellectually, like a person, whatever, to have a bad habit, smoking or drinking or whatever it is. And you can convince him with argumentation. But he still has the emotional. He still has a certain emotional draw. He's still drawn to it. So therefore it may be necessary sometimes to actually physically force him to give it up. Well, let's say, I know people have had, people have certain superstitions, which are wrong. I've explained that many times. Superstition is a form of idolatry. But I remember getting a guy in yeshiva one time saying, he knows it's stupid, but he just can't control it. Well, if a guy knows that it's stupid, so sometimes you have to take him physically, like a guy doesn't want to walk under the ladders. And physically, yeah, because that's the last break with the thing. A guy, in other words, his intellect is not powerful enough to draw the emotion out. So he's got to have an emotional experience, and then he can give it up. So sometimes it would seem then that this has such a powerful hold over them that they still have fear of these idols, these images. And we have to show them that there's nothing, that they're absolutely nothing, and to destroy them. And to show them that we live completely in line with our reason. We shouldn't follow our emotions, because their emotions were telling them that there's something there. And he had to show them But that's only after they were prepared intellectually. Once they were prepared intellectually, then he was able to take the step. So that's the combination. Sometimes you have to be active, you have to intervene. You have to actually intervene and destroy the object that a person is attached to. Of course, as you see, by the way, this is why when the Jews took over Eretz Yisrael, they were commanded to uproot every aspect of idolatry. You couldn't have anything lingering that people might be curious about. It has a tremendous pull. You have to realize the Rambam is telling us as introduction to all the laws of Avodah Zarah. There's a tremendous, Judaism goes to a tremendous extreme on Avodah Zarah. It goes way beyond the overt form of idolatry, any types of images and any types of superstitions and all these different practices. A tremendous degree of harchaka, and you're not allowed to get any benefit or any enjoyment out of anything which is associated with idolatry. So the Torah commands us to maintain a tremendous distance from idolatry. That's what emerges from all the laws of idolatry. And the reason for it is because the Torah recognized that it's a very powerful draw, very powerful attraction. And you see it in our time today. Even religious people have the same, the underlying emotions are very powerful, superstitious emotions. Of course, they try and take the superstitions and give them a religious coloring, as you said, things like the Ayin Hara, but they interpret it in a superstitious kind of a way. And even things like the mezuzah and different halakhic objects, they distort them into being protection, charm. Right? We discussed this very often. If something bad happens, they check the mezuzah. Yeah, their protection is gone. Their insurance is gone. Yeah, but you see, it's all that search. From this we can see what we're talking about over here. It's that underlying emotional search for that security, for that protection. I'm sorry. The shiver, the breaking of the idol, is the last phase in the educational process. That's the last stage in the educational process. It's like when a person hangs on to something and it keeps a memento. And you know that to get it, like, listen, I ask, make up any case you want. A person can't give something up, or a person was involved in a relationship, and you know that the other person is uninterested, but they're involved in a fantasy. Are you trying to work with them to see reason, reason demands if you give it up, the person's not coming back, or somebody dies, things like that. And the thing is, the last stages, you have to get rid of the mementos, or whatever the case may be. That's like an acceptance of reality. The breaking of the slum over here meant that they gave them up as God. But that was the last step in the education. Really, if they were on a higher level, it would not have been necessary. But they weren't on such a level. So, first he explained to them, and they were able to see it logically. And then, however, as long as the object was still intact, it exercised a certain hold on them, you have to realize. So the final detachment of the emotion to the object came about through smashing. When they saw that the thing was smashed, that's it. It lost its status. It lost its status as being something. But you have to realize that statues, you have to know something about the human psyche. Statues have a tremendous appeal to the imagination. Well, you see also the Statue of Liberty, for example. People don't regard it as consciously as a god. It's not a deity. It's not considered Avodah Zarah. But nevertheless, it's a very powerful emotional hold on people. And it has certain qualities to it. I mean, like the statue. Right? Mother Liberty or the Statue of Liberty. It's very important in the psyche of America. If somebody were to deface it, for example, it would be a terrible, terrible thing. It has like a certain mystical status. And what is it? It's just clay. But it comes to have a tremendous appeal to people. And it's very important in their lives. All right, so it's not a religious thing, but the emotions behind it can very easily become idolatrous. So therefore, to get them away from that, we're not talking about the Statue of Liberty. We're talking about a case where there's real, you're dealing with real objects. But you see, today, like the churches, the Catholics, they're completely involved in all these different things, saints and beads and crosses and all these different objects that are extremely important to them. And they think that these things have real significance and real meaning. Yes. You definitely should. You definitely should do that.
You have a choice.
The halachas that we're only commanded to pursue and uproot in Eretz Yisrael. That's one of the halachas. Outside of Eretz Yisrael, it's different. That's only if an area has come under our jurisdiction. We don't have control over here. So here it obviously would be crazy. We couldn't succeed. We couldn't succeed, and we would we'd be destroyed. We'd put ourselves in grave jeopardy. The Jews can't do that kind of thing. But the halacha is, for example, in Eretz Yisrael, when it's under our control, we have a chiyuv to uproot idolatry from the land. The only question would be, see, the question of Bizman Hazeh, I'm not postulating, obviously, we're just talking theoretically. The question about the status of Avodah Zarah and Eretz Yisrael Bizman Hazeh, the question is whether it's truly under our control and jurisdiction in the sense that we have the power to do so.
What better way to test that?
No. You can't just do that. You have to leave this to the Gedolim. Well, first of all, it's not a religious government. It's a secular government, so they wouldn't do it. Now, whether the Gedolim, if they had the power, would do so, you have to take into consideration the consequences. Do we really have that kind of control? There could be an uproar. Since Israel is not independent, Israel today, you have to realize, is not really independent in the full sense. It's a limited kind of independence, right? They're tremendously dependent upon America and world opinion. And don't forget, if Israel were to attack other religions, this would harm them and this would place the Jews in other countries in jeopardy. You follow what I'm saying? A lot of these things are interrelated. So therefore it might be that we simply don't have the control. But if the situation were to change and we were to become truly independent and we had the control, then we'd be obligated to do so. Alright? Alright, so there's what we did. That after we discussed yesterday, that after he discovered the true ideas, he then began to relate to the people of Urkastam. And the first thing he did was to break down their false ideas with rationality. So we said that there's two purposes in that. First of all, it's for his own benefit, because he clarifies his concepts, his ideas. And the second thing is for their benefit. Then we said Bashiba has one, that he broke the idols. And we explained that that wasn't a separate action. That wasn't unrelated. That was part of the process. But there is a point at which you have to forcibly remove a person from an attachment to a false emotion. In other words, it would seem he saw from this that their reason could take them only so far, but they still had an emotional attachment. And he had to break the emotional attachment. But without the groundwork, without the explanations, then the physical destruction of the idols by themselves would not have done anything, would have cured them. He was trying to cure them. And Shane Roy Lavos Elola Elokaolo. And he began to notify the people that it's not fitting to worship except the God of the world, the God of the universe, the creator of heaven and earth. Below Roy Lishtahavos. And to him is it fitting to bow down or Lahakar Vulanate, and to bring sacrifices and to pour libations. Now, the question is like this. Why did Abraham tell them that it's fitting to worship and to bow and to bring sacrifices? Where did he get that idea from? There's nothing in anything the Rambam says in his discoveries, Abraham's discoveries, in his reasoning, his philosophy, that would lead to the idea that one should bow down and to bring out sacrifices. Where did he get that idea from? As a matter of fact, you might think that he would discourage them from that, because that seems to smack of the whole mentality of idolatry. Here the people were speaking this kind of thing. So he, on the one hand, he tells them to break away, and he destroys the images. But then he says, you should worship and bow down and bring sacrifices to the God of the universe. Why should you do that? What was the reason for doing that? What about Avraham himself? Is that what he was engaged in? It doesn't mention, it should have said, that after Avraham made this discovery, he began to bring sacrifices. It doesn't say that. He began to bring sacrifices to the Elokei Ha'olam. He didn't. It doesn't say that he did anyway. So, where does this idea come from? Why did Abraham? I mean, the Torah commands us to bring sacrifices. That's part of the system. But where did Abraham get this idea from? And if anything, you would think he would... Right. He would not want them to do that. Discourage them from doing that. Okay, thanks. That, well, two things. If people are on the highest level, there's no need to sacrifice. Because why do you have to actually go through the... So why do you have to go through the procedure of bringing an animal and the whole sacrificial system? A person should live his life in accordance with the idea that God exists and he should relate to God, and all of his actions should be in line with getting closer to God, the true love of God, as we've gone through that. So why do you need to sacrifice? But nevertheless, you see, that's a very deeply rooted emotion. People have a very powerful emotional need. So what Shay is saying is correct, that it is not the emotion or the activity of sacrifice in and of itself which is an evil. Because you see that when Noah came out of the Arm Teva, the first thing he did was he offered a sacrifice to God. He had achieved a new recognition. So the act itself of sacrificing to God to demonstrate one's recognition that God is the master of the universe and that everything we have comes from God, that we are a created being, and we exist only because it's God's will that we should exist. And not, in other words, it's to break down an idea that we have. The idea of sacrifice really breaks down an idea. Because most people don't have the idea. Most people have the idea that it's our world. We're in control. Because that's all we see. Most people, even if they profess to believe in God on an emotional level, they're very much influenced by human power. That's what they respect the most. Deep down, that's what they really believe in. That's why they try and have powerful friends, and that's why to act correct socially is very important. Because for most people have the natural feeling that it's our world, we're in control, and everything exists for our sake. So the idea of, and it's mine, when a person acquires something, he earns something, he really feels it's his. He can do with it whatever he likes. You see, that's what it is in Mitzvah Torah. Baal Tashchis says you can't destroy something, even if it belongs to you. Something, you have a shirt, you can't tear it up. Because you're destroying something in the universe, not your universe. It's not yours. In fact, that's the idea incorporated in bracha. That if a person that eats without a bracha, it's like gezel. It's like gezel. Because really, you're saying that it's yours. You're in control. You're failing to recognize that it's only part of a system which has been created by God. And if you praise God and you have that recognition, then you're entitled to use things that have been created for a certain purpose. So the idea of sacrifice itself, even though a person shouldn't have to go, a person should have these ideas, should live according to these ideas. That's the Rambam meant. But the idea of sacrifice itself is not necessarily an evil. It all depends upon the underlying attitudes and the ideas that it's associated with. So that was their chait, that they, not that they brought sacrifices, but they brought sacrifices to the wrong object. They worship created beings. That leads to destruction. But Abraham saw that to tell them to give up all religious expression, to give up religion, to cease to be religious, and to be philosophical, that wouldn't have any lasting effect. That was an impossibility. So what did he do? He told them, you can still be religious. You can still be religious people. You can have your religious system with sacrificing, with worship, and so forth. But what the most vital thing that you must do is to redirect the religious activity from created beings to the master of the universe. If you can't do that, then you're an idolater. That's all Yad is demands from a person. That's the basic thing that Yad is demands from a person. That they redirect their religious energy from any created being and to relate only to the God of the universe. Whatever, and our concept of the God of the universe is a very limited one. We can't know God in a positive way. But we have to recognize that beyond the universe there's this infinite being who is not physical, in any, and he was not subject to any representation, can't be represented in any kind of form or figure. And that is the concept that we have in mind, this unknowable being who is the source of the universe. If we have in mind anything else other than that, any kind of an image, even if we think that it reflects, it's just a reflection of the Creator, that's idolatry. We abandon the past. But again, you see, if you take a look at what the Rambam says, why did he do this? In order that all of the future, you see, here is where he's involved in concern for future generations. In order that all future creatures should know God. What does that mean? That means that if he would have uprooted religion completely, then there'd be no future to these ideas. There'd be no kiyum. Because there are very few people that are going to maintain the philosophical system. It doesn't last. Philosophical systems don't last. Here's where you see where Abraham is different than the ordinary philosopher, and why he is chosen by God to be the founder of a special nation. Because he's involved in perpetuating the idea. And to perpetuate the idea, you can't deny the religious instinct in people. Yes. Well, the thing is, this idea that Avram was involved in trying to make sure that all future generations would know about God, this is brought down in Vayera, in Bereishis Yudches, Pasuk Yutet, when God says, shall I hide from Avram that which I'm going to do, but prior to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Ki yadatim l'man asher yitzaveh banav yisrei ta'afra, for I have known him because he's commanded his children and his household after him, b'sham b'darach Hashem, to keep, to preserve the way of God, lasa u'tzadak u'mishpat, to do tzadak u'mishpat. What you see from this is that the reason why God related to him and chose him as the father of many nations, that's Abraham, the father of many nations, is because he dedicated himself to not just being involved in mature ideas, but to perpetuating it for each generation. Now your question is, what happened? Let's say Abraham would have been on his own, how much would he have succeeded? What would have happened? I can't answer that question. We see that he had the ability to move people, because he went wherever he was, B'Shem Hashem, he had tremendous ability to relate to people, he won over people. Now, what would have happened to this movement had God then had a specific plan, that it should be through his son and his grandson and his family. In other words, God had a specific plan that the perpetuation should come about through a specific nation. There had to be a nation which was dedicated to this purpose. There were really two elements, I believe, in the plan. Let me just go into it right now. What were the two elements in the plan while we're on the subject? And this is, of course, why Abraham is considered to be the father of the Jewish nation. The two elements of the plan to perpetuate it, I think, first of all, required that there be a group which has the capacity to survive, which means that it has to be a nation, a separate nation, an Am. That's where the concept of Klal Yisrael comes from, the Am. Because even though it's a small nation and a weak nation, but a nation has the ability to survive in the framework of history. So, therefore, the first element was that there be a separate nation. God chose a nation. Now, that nation, how did it originate? It originated through the descendants of Abraham. That was God's desire. That should originate through the descendants of Abraham. And even, that was Moshe's argument. When God wanted to destroy the Jews with the Cheder Egel, and I'll make a nation out of you. Yeah. So again, God, again, I'll make a nation out of you. You see that that's God's will, that there be a nation. Except at that point, when the Jews were guilty, God was going to destroy them and create a new one out of Moshe. And Moshe was responsible for the Jews, right? That's right. And the way Chazal interpreted his argument was that a chair with three legs can't survive, now the three legs of the other can't stand, then how will a chair with one leg survive? Meaning to say that it's better in terms of God's plan that the nation be the one which is from the other, which descends from the other. That's the first element. What was the second element? The second element was the system of mitzvot. the creation of a system of mitzvot. And what is the idea of the mitzvah? The basic idea of the mitzvah. It means that there was a transformation. Originally, Judaism was philosophical, abstract philosophical ideas, true ideas about the existence of God, the nature, how we ought to relate to God, how we ought to live our life. These were concepts, these were ideas. So it was a philosophy of life. But in order for it to be perpetuated, it couldn't remain in the form of a philosophy. It had to be transformed and institutionalized into a system which satisfies people's religious needs as well. In other words, there's no other people that have this. In the world at large, you have philosophy, people that were involved in creating philosophical systems, and then you have, of course, religion, people that are involved in religion. Now, the religions have no philosophy, they have no truth, it's just an expression of the primitive emotion, so they're totally false. Now, philosophy, even true ones, not all philosophy are true, but even philosophies that had correct ideas had no way of maintaining themselves, of perpetuating themselves. For example, the Greeks. The Greeks had Socrates and Aristotle. According to the Rambam, they had some correct ideas. They were rationalists. And other philosophers throughout the ages came upon some true ideas, and they lived a decent way of life. But they perpetuate? Do you see anybody today that's an Aristotelian? That looked like Aristotle did? Or like Socrates? Or even other philosophers throughout the ages? They were never able to perpetuate their system of ideas. If anything, they may have had a few students in their own times, and maybe, but it died out. Because in order for it to survive, it has to be in the form of practices that have a tremendous appeal to people's instinctual makeup. When people begin, people start out without, they're not philosophical by nature. You have to take that into consideration, that people are not philosophical by nature, and that they are emotional by nature, and they need a religious system. So the ideas of the Torah were transformed into a system of mitzvot. So that appeals to people, it gives them religious activity. But once they're involved in the mitzvah, you see everything is chachma. You see, in order to perform any mitzvah, you can't just follow your emotions. You want to build a sukkah. You have any question, you want to serve God. But you can't just go out there and start building. You got to study the halacha. And the halacha is all rational, and it's concepts, it's ideas. And if you make one little mistake, the whole sukkah could be puzzled. So you see, it's taking an individual, and slowly but surely, it's redirecting him. It appeals to him, it attracts him on the basis of his religion, of his religious emotions, but in order to satisfy those emotions, it can only be satisfied through the utilization of the mind. So he learns to appreciate the world of ideas. That's the ultimate element. Those two elements, then, are the foundations of Yahadut. The idea of a nation, and the transformation into the system of Tariag Mitzvot. And the proof of all this, that the ultimate kiyum of the mitzvot is that a person should be perfected with regard to true ideas, is Talmud Torah Kenei Tulum. Talmud Torah Kenei Tulum. Everything, the essence of all the mitzvot is Talmud Torah. Why is the essence of all the Talmud Torah? Because only through Talmud Torah can a person gain a relationship with Hashem. Right? Shemitoch kachatem makir. Only through Talmud Torah that a person can have a real relationship with God. That's the whole purpose of Yahadut. To get rid of the false relationship to God that people maintain, and to substitute it with a real relationship. Yesterday we said that Abraham was involved in dealing with the people of her custom. In order that all the future generations should have a chance to know about God. Motivation. Then it says, we're in the middle now of Halacha Gimel. Tuchas Vodas Tuchamim. Terek Aleph Halacha Gimel. Toi la'abed u'l'shaber chalaturos. And it's fitting to destroy and to break all of the images. Kidei shlo yitu behen kol ha'am. In order that the people should not err in them. Now what does he mean? That it's fitting to destroy them. Of course, he's already made that point. Sheba had flown. The Rambam has already made the point before that he broke the Tzlanim. So obviously he told him that you have to break these things, that you have to uproot it. Now what does it mean that he told them that it's fitting to destroy and smash all of the images? In order that all the people should not be Torah. Kamalelu, like those, Shehem Medanim, Shein Sham Elu, Loka Ela Elu. That there's no God, as those who imagine that there's no God except these. I think he's saying over here what is that, of course, you have to break them. We had told them that originally, but that in order to maintain the true idea, you can't allow any replicas of them. You might think that it's enough to teach the correct ideas, and people shouldn't worship them. But he's saying further than that, you can't allow any of them to exist, even in a museum, because they have a tremendous attraction upon people. The images, there's a certain emotion in people to relate. Images have a way of bringing out a certain idolatrous emotion in people. And the Torah makes a big point about this. When the Jews enter the land, Abay Ta'abdim, as Kalam Kamos, you should totally destroy all the places that the Goyim worshipped over there. And the images, the idols, must be completely destroyed, ground to dust. You can't do anything with them. You certainly can't maintain them or keep them or put them in storage, because their very existence is a danger. The very existence of the image itself is a tremendous danger. And you see it has a tremendous hold upon people. Yeah, there's a tremendous effect upon people's emotions. Yeah? Kibun Shagavar Aleyim Barat Yosef, as soon as he began to overpower them with his proofs, see, Barat Yosef, he won them over. He defeated them with his proofs, with the logic of the argument. Bikei Shamelach Lahargo, the king sought to kill him. Vinafalo Neis, and a miracle was performed to him. In other words, God intervened. The Yotel Lechara, and he went to Chara. That's how the Rambam learns Pshat. Now, why did the king seek to kill him? That's the question. It doesn't mention at all that he's involved in any kind of political activity, or that he sought to overthrow the government or the king. The Rambam doesn't explain that to us, so it's something we should try and understand on our own. It comes out of nowhere. He didn't have anything to do with the politics. He wasn't involved in politics. And yet, the king sought to kill him. Yeah, why would you think? I would say that even though he wasn't directly against the king, but religion was vital to the maintenance of the authority, because the king wasn't ruling by any kind of a democratic system or any kind of a rational system. So he needed something to keep the people's emotions in check. In other words, to keep them in a state of obedience. Now, obviously, the religious system served that purpose. Who's it? Marx said that religion is the opium of the masses. The opium, you know that expression?
You said that?
Marx. That religion is the opium of the masses. They're opium, like a drug. Well, I don't know exactly the sense that he meant it in, but there is no question that it's a vital element in the control of society. Freud wrote a book. It's called, The Future of an Illusion. The Future of an Illusion. Because he didn't believe in religion at all. So he had his whole explanation of how it came into being. But of course, he regarded it as being an illusion, that people are functioning in a certain way because they have these religious illusions. And he was showing why they're not beneficial, and rationally they should be removed. He thought people should function ethically and morally on a rational basis. So he wrote the whole book over there about the future, that in the future people, mankind, will raise itself to a higher level, and it will be able to dispose with religion. I don't agree with him at all. I mean, I agree with him on his analysis that all religions in the world, except the Yahdis, are man-made, and they are illusions. I mean, I agree with his basic analysis. But when he speaks about religion, And when I say that I agree with him, I'm referring to man-made religion, Christianity or Islam or any other system. Other than Yahadis is unique, it's different, it's revelation, it's God's revelation. But with regard to those systems, it is true. However, I disagree with his analysis that I think he's overestimating the power of reason. And that's very strange for a person whose whole life he was involved in showing the power of the instinct. That man is basically, in fact, that's why people oppose him, because they thought he reduced man to being nothing more than a series of instincts and an animal and so forth, that he underestimated the other side of man. I happen to disagree. I think that practically speaking, of course, the Emosa Mashiach is something different, but the world as it is today, if there were no religion, that's the only force in the world that does exercise a control over people, so that even false religions have that benefit, so to speak. I'm not saying that therefore there's something good. I don't want to say there's anything good about Christianity. I don't mean it. Or that we shouldn't oppose it. But insofar, where these religions are enforced, they do exercise a practical control upon people's aggressiveness. Of course, the price is the destruction of the soul, because people are involved in idolatry. That's something else. But you see also, in recent times, one of the contributing factors in the breakdown of society, the increase in lawlessness and violence, is, again, the weakening of traditional religion. That's part of the process. In the last 30, 40 years or so, traditional religion has lost its hold upon people.
It keeps
people in line. And to the extent that it becomes less of a force, less operative, there's nothing there to replace it. This confirms, by the way, what we've just learned in the last few days, that you couldn't just give over the Torah as a series of ideas, as a philosophical system. It has to be incorporated into something which affected the religious emotions. The only way to control people is through a system which does hit their emotions, because people are emotional by nature. The only thing is, though, that if you're affecting their emotions, does that mean that the substance, the content itself, is going to be an irrational belief system that's idolatry? Or can one do so through a system which is based upon correct ideas? That's Yahadis. Yes, so Socrates held that knowledge is virtue, that if one knows the good, then it's impossible for him to sin. That happens to be true. We agree with that. Now, of course, people ask, but there are people that know. On the surface, it would seem that we don't agree, because it always says if a person is chachma, is greater than fear, right? Then his chachma is not. So you see that people have knowledge and they sin anyway. But you have to understand what we mean by knowledge is not just an abstract intellectual comprehension, but it has to mean something which all of one's emotions are in line with his conviction. It's a conviction which affects all of his emotions. If a person is absolutely convinced that something is true, he's not going to go operate against it. It's impossible. Man by nature cannot harm himself. That's an interesting kind of thing. Is that man by nature cannot harm himself, cannot willfully harm himself. No matter what he's doing, even if he's destroying himself, he's committing suicide. At that moment, of course, his reason is distorted, but the underlying determining factor is his desire to preserve himself. He's doing something which is for his own, in his own mind, that's for his benefit. In other words, his cheshbon is that life is so terrible that this is better for me. I'm better off dead. Or if he's killing somebody else, no matter what crazy thing he's doing, at that moment, he's satisfying something which convinces him that this is better for him. It's a question over here, that this is what brought him into conflict with the king. Because the king sensed that he was undermining the whole basis for his authority. Because his authority rested upon the fact that people would be naturally obedient and would not question. They had certain myths. And these myths predetermined how they would behave in the society. So the whole thing made sense. It fitted in. It fitted in very well. But once Abraham broke it down, so then there was the danger that they would no longer accept the authority of the king. But more than that, I think there's a similarity here with what happened to Socrates. Anybody that begins to question the unquestionable in any society is going to get into big trouble. and it operates even in democracy, even in Jewish society. In other words, the general Jewish part, even the Orthodox, will accept a certain amount of questioning. But that questioning is already, it's accepted as part of our tradition. Of course, right. But if you go beyond that and you question in a certain way, where there's no holds barred kind of question, and forcing people to defend their premises where they cannot do so, then you're going to encounter hostility. And, well, whatever practical consequences, that depends. But in a society, once you start to question the fundamental premises and you show them that their whole life is nonsense, if you go around a Christian and you start to show them that the whole system is complete foolishness and nonsense, you're going to get into tremendous trouble. And Athens, well, what happened in Greece? Athens was basically democratic, but that didn't matter. It was not democratic enough to permit someone like Socrates to rationally question people's beliefs. That's all he was doing. But there is the realization among the authorities that if this is permitted to go on, then it's going to lead to revolutionary change. There's no confidence. It shows you that underneath it all, people do not have confidence that what they believe in is defensible. It's an amazing thing. When people react that way, it's one thing if a person says, I don't have sufficient knowledge, and therefore I don't want to engage in this type of discussion or questioning because it's going to shake me up. That's one thing. I can understand that. That makes sense. You should not. You should avoid. In other words, like Rashi was speaking about sophistry in the Sunday morning show, the sophist that had a way of breaking down and distorting, but you can break down by distorting, like lawyers do in a courtroom. You know, they can take anything and make it sound, they can totally distort anything until you can't even see clearly. They were called the sophists. They went around just breaking any idea down. They were very sophisticated. Sophisticates, where the word comes from. The ability to make something appear differently. To distort, there are good lawyers. That is exactly what a lawyer is trained to do. That's why it's one of the most corrupting professions. I mean this very seriously. Aside from the fact that they allow criminals who should be locked up, they use their skills to allow these people, these Rishayim, to go free. Aside from that, the very practice of the art, the great lawyers are those, that's what they're admired for. That a guy comes in, another guy comes in with an airtight thing, it's clear as day, and this guy can twist things around very subtly, until it's not clear anymore, it's distorted. So he's using the intellect, whose purpose is to enlighten, to cause confusion, distortion. So, now I'm saying like this, practically speaking, our attitude is that everything that our beliefs are totally defensible, are totally true, and they're all intelligible and rational. However, therefore we engage in questioning. But there too, you got to use your seichel. It doesn't mean to say that we would subject ourselves to a person should realize that he doesn't know enough in an area. And somebody, if he were to expose himself to certain kinds of argumentations, which he really wouldn't know how to refute, then that would be foolish because it would really have a damaging effect upon him. But the underlying idea is that we have no fear about the fact that our system is founded upon the most firm ground. Now that's different in any other system, or Christianity, Bahá'í, any system, basically, I mean, they openly admit that it's a faith, that it's not irrational, it's not subject to rationality.
So Judaism is atheism?
In other words, the question has been raised whether we follow Judaism out of belief or out of knowledge. Well, the word belief has to be defined. What do you mean by belief? This is a very important idea. If you say that you're Jewish because you believe, now believing is because I feel a certain way about it, I feel so strongly about it, then I would say that's not our foundation. That is a false foundation. Because then you're ascribing truth to the picture of reality that is given to you by your feelings. then you're really no different than anybody else, because everybody else operates in life on the basis of his feelings. So that is maybe what your philosophy professor, this guy was saying, or whatever, that therefore, since it's your feelings, the reason why you feel that way is not because of anything out there, but simply because of other factors, how you've been raised and so forth. But if you say you believe because your mind has told you, you have sufficient reason to believe that this is true, that this is a divine system, that this is worth living by, then yes, that belief. So in other words, of course, we keep the Torah because of belief, but the belief is founded not upon our feelings, but upon objective criteria. Objective criteria, knowledge, which the same area of the mind which gives us our convictions in other areas pertaining to reality, when it comes to science, when it comes to medicine, and so forth, that's the same area of the mind that gives us conviction over here, that this is the correct way. So our belief, of course we can do it out of belief, but the belief is one which is not founded just upon such a feeling, but rather it's founded upon objective criteria. If a person studies the fact, he will come to the conclusion that this is the true religion. Everybody's a rationalist when they're dealing with a palpable physical reality. Everybody becomes rational. I mean, unless they want to commit suicide. A person who's not suicidal will act in a rational way when their life is, when their vital interests are at stake, they will act in a rational way. That is true. However, in the religious realm, since they don't see any physical, there's no physical basis, see, they're dealing with the soul, they're dealing with entities that you can't show them in a physical way what's going to happen and so forth. So there's room for people to indulge their emotions. There's room. They want to indulge their emotions. Yes, they would like to live their entire life that way, but they have no choice because they do accept reality. So when you're in a situation where a person is forced to accept reality, you'll see he'll become a rationalist. When a person is in a situation of survival and when he has to think and make decisions, he will become a rationalist. He's not just going to follow. I mean, unless he's paralyzed, he gets paralyzed or whatever. You know, he can't function. But they will recognize that rationality is the best mode of operating. However, in this area, they're acting against their own principles. They're acting irrationally because they are willing to entrust their soul to a feeling about something which is a differentiation whatsoever. And the fact that 50 million other people have the same feeling, so what? Doesn't really, I mean, what? Why does that prove? After we study history, we see that the whole nation, they wouldn't believe in Nazism because 80 million Germans accepted it. You know, we don't accept that kind of thing. To admit, though, that there are cases where there's a conflict, where a person will have a very severe conflict between what his senses tell him and his religious beliefs. Now, because you could ask me, there are these Christian scientists that won't allow certain medical procedures, blood transfusions and so forth, against all reality, letting their... That's against their beliefs. I don't remember anymore why, but the way they've worked it out, a person can come to any conclusion. You can take what they call the Bible, the scriptures, and without the correct interpretation, a person can make up anything you want. That's why you have so many different religions, and they all base themselves on the same text, because you can twist it and turn it any way you want. That's why we need a Masorah. But there are people that do have that conflict, that their emotional attachment to the religion would be in conflict with their sense of reality. That is true. And there are people that would opt. So there are people that would opt to be religious in a life and death situation. That's a very rare thing, though.
So
it's interesting that you see, in general, though, religion didn't go that way. Most religions, all religions, they never went that far to demand that of people. Why not?
Some religions,
yeah, why not?
Some religions
They claim these things of faith healing and this and that and faith and everything is faith. Yet when it comes down to it, they all say go to a doctor. And have faith, but go and pray, but go to a doctor. Now we say that because we're basing ourselves on that's the will of God. God that created the system of nature, God wants us to function within the framework of nature. That's reality. That's part of our religious belief. But in the others, there's an element of a contradiction. They realize that they can't. They can't ask it of people. It would never go. But there is a minority, though, that it does work.
Yes, you already make a good point that people, let's say, you must believe that Gamzu, that things would work out all right. Like you said, like, how do you know?
What's the basis for that?
If you have a basis for it, you can prove it to me, so then it's a rational thing. But you see that there's a contradiction, because on the one hand, they'll say that you have to have that belief, and on the other hand, they'll criticize people, the Jews in Europe, that didn't get out in time, that stayed. Well, those people, let's say, said Gandhi will tell you, things will work out. They had faith. Now he criticizes them for having faith. Suppose Jews in Europe would have taken the attitude that, things look bad, they didn't have anti-Semitism on the horizon and stuff. So we have a moon and a curse birth, but God will help us.
And moon and money.
So now, according to you, they were correct. They were acting properly. One should act. Not thankfully to those people.
No, but even according to you, they can even find their
own. Well, how are they going to do it?
They can say,
you're caught in the mind. If I follow your principle of the moon, that you have faith that God will work things out, well, what happened to them? They followed it. On the other hand, you see, that's not the case. Yeah, Sean, Sean is saying it's true. That basically, of course, whatever happens, which is in the universe, anything that occurs is for the good, in the sense that God has a plan. And even a thing like the Holocaust has to happen. Of course, we're not saying that the phenomenon itself wasn't good, it was bad. But it's not without a reason. And it was necessary. We just don't understand what all the factors were. And it's too soon to even know. But we do know that it was a phenomenon which was caused by God himself. But I don't think that the average person in that framework believes that. I think it means like if you lose a job and this and that, those also good. You have the sense that it'll work out good in a palpable physical way. You'll get a better job or a new situation. Well, they're looking for certain physical proof. So they're operating, I think, in a different framework. Not in your framework. Your framework is completely different. Because you don't mean in that framework that it's for the good. That's what it's the stupidity of people that try and justify the Holocaust that way. And they say, well, as we go through the Holocaust, we now have Earth. Which is a stupid argument, because what kind of an idea is that? Yeah, what kind of compensation? What kind of an idea is that? They're trying to explain away something which is a negative, in a particular framework, and trying to show that no. In that very same framework, I'll show you that it's not. It will tell. But that's absurd. It's not going to work. That's the problem with that answer. Yeah, you said that pain is not synonymous with happiness. I'm sorry. Pleasure is not synonymous with happiness, and pain is not synonymous with unhappiness. Because that could be proven, that a person could be experiencing pleasure and be unhappy. And a person can be experiencing pain and be happy. Well, give us the example of a case where a person is experiencing pleasure and yet he's unhappy.
Involved.
Example of masochism, where a person experiences pleasure out of pain. That's a complicated psychological phenomenon. Books have been written about that. But nevertheless, it's not what we're talking about, because that's simply, we're still talking about pleasure
and pain.
And the irony that the person can experience pleasurable sensations as a result of painful ones. Still doesn't. We're equating. With that person, look at a masochist who's experiencing pleasure. We're talking about a different issue. That pleasure cannot be equated with happiness.
A person can have pleasure
and not be happy. I guess a person taking drugs, for example, is not happy. But you get pleasure out of the drug.
Or if they just
not. Or a person that's
addicted
gets pleasure out of the cigarette, but it's not.
He's
unhappy because he knows that he's destroying himself.
Let's say someone works out. I mean, let's say this is a job a few miles too, where you're doing it, you're not experiencing.
Well, that would be an example of the other case.
No, conversely, a person can be working out, experiencing pain,
but he's happy
because he believes that he's keeping himself in good condition. So you see that
could be, I say. I didn't say that.
Yeah, it has to be that way.
Most people have a good workout.
Let me get another case where a person... the classical case. I couldn't think of it. The classical case of where a person is experiencing pleasure and is not happy is that delicious, superbly prepared last meal. The person is being executed, so they give him his last meal, and he gets the best. The greatest dinner that's ever been made.
And he's enjoying every bite of it.
But you can't tell me that he's happy.
I don't think he's really happy at that moment.
Yet he is experienced, but boy, the guy does eat it. I always struck me as ironic. I don't know what the idea of the last meal is. I think it's a factor of guilt.
It's the last involvement in the physical.
Yeah, well, that's true. But the guy's being killed. Why do we have to give him a delicious meal before he goes? But nevertheless, it's sort of like an amenity. I think that the society does that out of guilt. You don't find that in Yadis. We have the death penalty.
We don't find it. What do we have? What's the last thing that we have?
No.
The last thing that we have for the guy
is tshuva. Exactly. Seriousness. It should be opposite. Because a delicious meal taking him out of reality. Again, it's getting to all of the illusions and fantasies that brought us to this situation in the first place. Tshuva is a machaper in Bez and Shalmaila.
But it is not a poter from
Shalmata. A guy who's had a decent batch of tshuva will not help.
Is it no use of tshuva?
The misa will be a machaber. The punishment will be for the soul. For the soul in the world to come. But it's not going to pater him from his obligation to the system.
And did he go avodah?
Yes. Kalamum to the zadi. All who are executed, these vidui, v'yeshlan kalabram avodah. That was David's famous. I quoted you many times. They used to embarrass David. The wise guys of his generation, the slanderers, but the chait that he was involved in was Bashev, that old mice. So his enemies used to try and embarrass him, but they did it sophisticatedly. And they used to ask him questions, like pretending to ask a question on Allah. And they said, a Boel, Eishadish, when it was a Boel Eishadish, Yisasa Bama, what is his death? Right, obviously, they weren't asking it. Because they want to embarrass him. So his answer was, Misasa b'chenek, v'yesh lo chelek lo amhava. Right? Well, his death is with
strangulation, but he had a share in the world to come.
Ava mal b'tidei chadeo b'rabim, ein lo chelek lo amhava. But one who embarrasses his friend, publicly, has no share in the world to come. So,
which
the thing is, that you see that if a person deserves execution, so that that's a serious trait, obviously, and that's an onesh, but the soul has a share in the world to come, provided he does tshuva. If he doesn't do tshuva, then it's not a machaper. That's why before we execute a person, it's a very serious, very solemn stuff. We don't do either. And that's the biggest mystery you can do. They did give him a drink. They gave him a drink to calm his nerves, so he shouldn't sit there, because we did not want, as a principle, you see the principle in Sanhedrin, that you're not allowed to increase in any way. You can't delay, and so on and so forth. It's called Barolo Misa Yofa. To choose a Misa Yofa. So therefore, to dull the senses that he shouldn't go out of his mind or with hysteria, so they gave him a drink to calm him down. But it wasn't the idea of a last meal.
Yeah,
the idea in America or in other countries is that last meal. I think more America. I didn't know about every country like that. But the last meal concept, in my opinion, that's the Christian thing. That's two ideas involved. First of all, guilt. It's like you feel sorry for the guy. You put in a conflict because you're just operating on the emotional. On the one hand, you have to get rid of this guy. On the other hand, emotionally, you feel he's doing the wrong thing.
It's not nice to feel doing the wrong thing.
They don't kill him. They can't resolve it. That's why the society is put.
See, in the other, it's not the same thing. It's a different action altogether.
So, the idea of the last meal is to show you're a nice guy.
You really don't hate the guy.
And the way you do it is by the physical. by granting him
his wish.
Because what is the what are you doing? It really said merely. I can understand it now psychologically. Because what is death to them?
I never heard of this before.
Because to them, what is death? Death means the loss of physical existence.
The loss of your physical faculty.
So how do you? So what can I do for this guy? I'm taking you away all this physical faculty. At least I give him a great meal. That's not without really, there was the other side of it, which they just can't do. You understand the point?
Yeah. Really, what they last meal is the last orgy. What they really would like to do is
give the guy that major orgy, which is the last for all his eternity,
to make up. But they try to compensate. The idea of the last meal is compensation.
I'm taking away your physical fantasy. So I feel guilty about that.
So therefore, I'll give you something. Now, I can't give you the full package because the practice
thing will be, terrible. You can't give a guy an orgy and all that. So they give him the last meal.
That's really what I believe it's symbolic of. I never understood that before.
The idea of eating a last meal before you're executed is completely absurd.
Like, what do you need all this food for?
It would be like filling up a cup.